kqed.org. Here and now, coming up the second hour in just a minute, after we check in with Elaine Leung, with Julie Deppish, that is, taking over for Elaine Leung. She has traffic out in the East Bay, and hope you're staying cool, Julie.
Hi, Dave. Yeah, it's definitely getting warm, and are dealing with a big crash in Hercules Highway 4 east after Franklin Canyon. A couple vehicles here still block the left lane. Traffic comes to a standstill at Sycamore Avenue. Out in Vacaville, that's an entry crash on eastbound 80 just after 505. Both vehicles in the center divide there, and lots of debris in the middle lane. Some better news in Mountain View. They've just cleared that two-car wreck north 101 after Ellis Street, looking better from 237. Julie Deppish for KQED.
Today, the news quiz at 5:48 p.m. Listen for today's quiz question and go to kqed.org/radio news quiz. You'll get a chance to win a two-night stay at Canyon Ranch Woodside. KQED San Francisco, KQEI North Highlands, 12 noon.
Funding for Here and Now comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From NPR and WBUR in Boston, I'm Asma Khalid.
And I'm Deepa Fernandez. It's Here and Now.
Coming up, the ACLU says it's suing the Biden administration over its new immigration plan that severely limits the number of people who can claim asylum at the border.
Also, Mexico City's water problems are so dire, there's concerns the city's taps are close to running dry.
There's a big dollar amount between the water infrastructure that we have and the water infrastructure that we need for a growing population and the changing climate.
And 2 years ago, the U.S. Supreme Court overturned Roe versus Wade, the result of years of work by conservative activists.
The anti-abortion movement was finding ways to amass power and create this unstoppable machine.
Coming up on Here and Now.
The news is first.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi Singh. Excessive heat warnings are now in effect for much of the desert southwest and California. NPR's Kirk Sigler reports cities are mobilizing efforts to protect elderly residents and individuals who are unhoused.
Extreme heat warnings are expected to affect upwards of 10 million Westerners this week. Forecasters say Phoenix and Las Vegas could hit 112 during this so-called heat dome event. Queen Anune is deputy chief of Las Vegas Fire and Rescue. She's urging people to stay indoors unless it's an emergency. And first responders are expecting an uptick in calls for heat cramps, exhaustion, and heat stroke.
And also call 911. The earlier you notify 911 during these heat emergencies, the better the outcome will be for the patients.
Cities from Vegas to Tucson, Arizona are opening extra cooling centers, and city workers are planning to distribute heat aid kits to the homeless that include reusable water bottles, electrolytes, and instant ice packs. Kirk Sigler, NPR News.
The president of Mexico says his government's close to reaching a deal with the U.S. on deporting non-Mexican migrants directly back to their home countries rather than Mexico. At a press conference today, President Andrés Manuel López Obrador was asked about President Biden's executive order that aims to significantly reduce the flow of unauthorized migrant crossings into the U.S., a hotly debated issue this election year. Here's NPR's Ada Peralta.
Mexican President Andrés Manuel López Obrador says he talked with President Biden about addressing the root causes of migration.
De todas formas, nosotros cooperamos.
But either way, he said, we will cooperate and help President Biden. For years, Mexico has been in lockstep with the U.S. as it tightened its asylum policy. Indeed, without that cooperation, the policy of express deportations would not be possible. The United States turns back tens of thousands of non-Mexican citizens each month. The new, more restrictive asylum policy from the U.S. would mean many more would remain in Mexico. President López Obrador did not explicitly say whether Mexico would allow more deportees. Ada Peralta, NPR News, Mexico City.
King Charles and Queen Camilla of Britain are presiding over D-Day anniversary commemorations in southern England today. NPR's Lauren Frere reports from London.
An 80-piece orchestra, choir, Royal Marine drummers, and actors in 1940s dress, performing for the royals, the UK Prime Minister, and an audience of World War II veterans, many of them 100 years old. They gathered in Portsmouth, the harbour in southern England, where UK forces launched their Normandy assault 80 years ago this week.
That's NPR's Lauren Frere reporting from London. President Biden is in Europe to attend D-Day events this week. The Dow is up 118 points. You're listening to NPR News.
Live from KQED News, I'm Brian Watt. San Mateo County leaders are vowing to rebuild an affordable housing complex under construction near Redwood City, which burned down on Monday. KQED's Vanessa Roncagno reports.
San Mateo County needs to build more than 1,200 units of affordable housing in the next few years to meet the expected demand. The 179 apartments in the destroyed building would have helped close that gap. Board of Supervisors President Warren Slocum represents the district where the complex is located. He says the project was 10 years in the making.
It's just a devastating loss in terms of affordable units. We're all committed to rebuilding. We're not just going to walk away from it.
Slocum says insurance should cover much of the cost of rebuilding, and the county will likely seek state and federal funds to make up the difference. I'm Vanessa Rancagno, KQED News.
Julie Hayner, who has been an anchor at KTVU for more than a quarter of a century, is retiring. Hayner announced her decision during Channel 2's 6 p.m. newscast on Tuesday.
I have decided that I'm going to end my career here at KTVU. It's been a long time coming. It's been 27 years, and I don't want to get sad, but just to have a place like the Bay Area to live and work and cover stories and report on stories that matter to people and deliver the news for this long has been a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity.
Hayner's last day will be June 20th. The Giants start up in Arizona in a half an hour. The A's play again, hosting the Mariners tonight. And the Ballers play their second home game against the YOLO High Wheelers at around the same time. I'm Brian Watt. Thanks for listening to KQED News.
Afternoon support comes from European Sleepworks in Berkeley, where research-driven design helps yield sustainable mattress comfort. Learn more at sleepworks.com. Support for NPR comes from Fisher Investments. As a fiduciary, Fisher Investments is obligated to act in their clients' best interest. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. And the listeners and members of KQED Public Radio. Warm to hot today, the rest of the afternoon for the Bay Area. Lows in the 70s near the water, low 100s far inland. Sacramento Valley, again, very hot. Sacramento's high today, 100. Look for a cooler temperature tomorrow, maybe 100 degrees. Cooler still by the end of the week.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Asma Khalid in Boston. And I'm Vipa Fernandez in Alameda, California. It's Here and Now. The American Civil Liberties Union says it will file a lawsuit against the Biden administration for its new executive order limiting access to asylum. Yesterday, President Biden announced a policy to suspend the processing of asylum claims at the southern border when the number of migrants crossing the border reaches a seven-day average of 2,500 per day. The suspensions will remain in place until the seven-day average number of crossings falls below 1,500 a day. It allows for exceptions for unaccompanied children and victims of human trafficking. The new policy went into effect at midnight. The ACLU says it is unlawful. Lee Gallant, an attorney for the ACLU, joins us now. Lee, welcome. Tell us why the ACLU is suing the Biden administration over this new executive order.
Yeah, sure. Thanks for having me. This is similar to an asylum restriction that President Trump tried. We sued then successfully, and we see no choice but to sue now. We think it's equally illegal what President Biden is doing. That's not to equate President Biden and President Trump's immigration policies generally, but we do think this policy is misguided. What Congress Yes.
What part is illegal? Could you spell that out for us?
Yeah. So the main part is that you cannot limit asylum depending on where people enter. What this does is say, if you enter between ports, you're not going to be screened for asylum. And what Congress and international law have been very clear about is, if you get to U.S. soil, you have to be given a screening for danger for asylum. And the reason is because people can't always get to a port, either because cartels are pushing them to enter between ports, or the ports are hundreds and hundreds of miles away and they can't get there, especially if they're with a young child. And on top of that, there are very few spots left open at the ports, and you need technology to make an appointment. It can take months and months. And so the law is very clear and has been, and that's why we succeeded under Trump, that The law says whether or not you enter at a port or between ports, you have to be screened for asylum. This is going to put a lot of people in danger.
So the U.S. is signatory also, as you mentioned, to international law that protects a person's right to seek asylum. There's also U.S. law. I want to read here. It protects the safety of from persecution or a well-founded fear of persecution on account of race, religion, nationality, membership in a particular social group or political opinion. So what you're saying is that under this executive order, that principle is not being upheld?
That's exactly right. It's not being upheld under domestic law, and it's inconsistent with international law. And I want to be very clear about a couple of things. One is, we are not saying that everyone's entitled to asylum, but what we are saying is under domestic and international law, everyone has to be screened for asylum. And we said, this country said after World War II, we made a solemn promise we would no longer send people back to danger without even a screening. And the second point I want to make is we don't see this as a balanced approach. We get that the American public wants something done on immigration, but we think they want a balanced approach. And I think if you ask people, if a family comes here and they have been persecuted, perhaps with deadly force because of their religion, would you at least want them to be screened for asylum? Mm-hmm. I think most people would say, yes, this policy does not even do that.
So let's talk about ways to do that. But first, President Biden spoke yesterday. Let's take a listen.
I'm moving past Republican obstruction and using the executive authorities available to me as president to do what I can on my own to address the border. Frankly, I would have preferred to address this issue through bipartisan legislation because that's the only way to actually get the kind of system we have now that's broken, fixed.
Okay, so he says the system's broken. Many agree with him. Mayors in border towns say they're overwhelmed with the number of migrants coming in. What would be a legal way to reform the asylum process?
So I think there's two important things that we need to do without completely abandoning screenings for people who enter between ports so we have a balanced approach. One is we need more legal pathways for people to enter, and in particular for workers. I don't know of a single economist now who is saying we don't need more workers, including particularly immigrant workers. If there are legal pathways for people to come, there won't be this clogging at the border. The second thing is, rather than more enforcement, we need more asylum officers at the border, and that means more resources, but I think President Biden could have surged more asylum officers to the border, because what that means is faster, more streamlined processing, which we are in favor of. And that means that if you don't have a proper asylum claim, you're going to be sent back, unfortunately. But if you do, your hearing will take place quicker and you'll come in. So the worker programs will eliminate how many people are at the border. And it will also mean for those people who have asylum claims, they can be screened more quickly. But this approach is not balanced.
We have just a few moments left. The ACLU sued, as you said, the Trump administration a number of times over its immigration policies. What are you hoping to see with this suit against the Biden administration?
So we're hoping that this policy will be invalidated and that President Biden will then come up with better solutions. We would like the president to pull back on his own. I think that's probably not going to happen. But if the policy is invalidated, we'd like to see or comprehensive immigration reform even better, which the president is in favor of.
Legal Alert with the American Civil Liberties Union. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
The Atlantic hurricane season is here, and forecasters are predicting that this will be one of the most active seasons on record, which means extra work for the Air Force's weather reconnaissance unit known as the Hurricane Hunters. NPR's Debbie Elliott met some of them.
Six airmen are gathered around a conference table at Keesler Air Force Base in Biloxi, Mississippi, looking at conditions for the day.
We are TL-97 today, weather line. We're on 00, spot 15.
First Lieutenant Zach McDermott, the pilot, is briefing the crew before a Hurricane Hunter training flight over the Gulf of Mexico.
I was thinking at some point today we run through the INVEST checklist. get ready since storm season's a week away.
The 53rd Weather Reconnaissance Squadron is the only U.S. military unit tasked to collect real-time information for hurricane forecasters. They fly over, around, and through dangerous storms, piercing the eye wall as the propeller aircraft are pelted at times by hail and winds topping 150 miles an hour.
There's the cliche, it's like a roller coaster in a car wash.
That's Lieutenant Colonel Stephen Burton, Deputy Operations Commander with the Hurricane Hunters. He says the squad's roots date back to 1943.
It was a barbette. They were in Corpus Christi. I bet you can't get a fly through that hurricane out there.
A pilot took the bet, and the Hurricane Hunters were born.
About 115 miles south of Mobile over the Gulf right now.
Hurricane Hunters fly C-130 Super Hercules, basically a military cargo plane fitted with weather equipment and the ability to deploy instruments including weather buoys and something called a drop sond.
Hey, pilot, weather. Yep, we're still good to drop in 8. You're clear on the left, clear on the right. On your call, weather. All right, Luke, you can go release sond now. Sond away.
Staff Sergeant Donnie Arsenault, the loadmaster on the flight, deployed the drop sond through the belly of the plane. It's a compact weather station that looks like a paper towel roll with a tiny parachute attached.
Every quarter second, we get a tick of data back. That data consists of the temperature, humidity, and GPS location. Using the GPS location, we can track where it moves in the hurricane.
It measures wind speed and direction and atmospheric pressure. First Lieutenant Mark McCoy, the weather officer on board, sends the readings within 10 seconds to the National Hurricane Center so forecasters can better predict a storm's threats ahead of landfall.
All that most up-to-date information on what's going on in the storm system is critical for them to be able to find out how to forecast where the hurricane's going, is it intensifying or is it weakening.
Information used to determine what communities to evacuate and when, and where to stage emergency crews and relief supplies.
I think of this as a combat mission. We are protecting our coastline from these storms.
Colonel William McGee is the maintenance group commander who oversees the mechanics who keep the Hurricane Hunter fleet up and running, a tall task given they have the same 10 planes assigned to the group back in 1996. Since, their mission has expanded. They track tropical systems in the Atlantic and Pacific. Then a few years ago, they were tasked with a winter season, flying in northeast storms and the atmospheric rivers that hit the West Coast.
In years past, that was the time in which we recovered. We recovered our airplanes, we came home and saw our families, but now, instead of flying about half the year, we fly about 10 months out of the year. And so we're in a deployed status almost all the time. That's wear and tear on this unit.
McGee says since 2018, they've seen a six-fold increase in demand for winter reconnaissance missions and a 20% uptick in tropical flights. Yet the Hurricane Hunters are working with the same number of planes and crew. That means tough choices. For instance, at one point last year, there were two hurricanes, but they could only fly into one, McGee says, while they waited on repair parts. Hurricane Hunter commanders are making their case to Congress that they need additional resources. That's welcome news to the crew on this training flight. Pilot Zach McDermott says there's a cumulative impact from responding to everything they're tasked to cover when Mother Nature doesn't let up.
There's no downtime and there's not an extensive amount of time for training like we did tonight because we're constantly flying these task missions. More people and more airplanes could help, you know, spread out that workload that we have.
The Hurricane Hunters are unique, says Commander McGee, and need some relief.
There's a lot of combat units out there. There's one Hurricane Hunter unit, and we're it. And so if not us, then who? Well, there is no one else.
A mission McGee says they take seriously because lives are saved with more accurate hurricane forecasts. Debbie Elliott, NPR News, Biloxi, Mississippi.
Stay with us. Just ahead, the ecosystem of activists, lawmakers, and judges who helped overturn the Supreme Court's landmark decision of Roe v. Wade, ending the right to an abortion. You're listening to Here and Now.
For months, hospitals across Gaza have been shutting down as Israeli raids and evacuation orders push from north to south. And without access to medical care, children there are dying.
There is lack of food, lack of proper nutrition, proper medication. It, unfortunately, it is not in our hands.
I'm Mary Louise Kelly. Hear that report on All Things Considered from NPR News.
The report, other stories, the latest news coming up at 1 today, then the world at 2.
Fatherhood is getting a makeover in Japan with images that make doting dads look cool.
Makeup.
This is masculinity too, being a good dad.
Can getting dads more involved make a difference in Japan's plummeting birth rate? Next time on The World.
And that's After All Things Considered, 2 to 3 today, then the PBS NewsHour. Support for KQED comes from Broadway SF, presenting Company, the Tony-winning best revival of a musical that reimagines one of Stephen Sondheim's most beloved works, at the Orpheum Theater now through June 29th. Tickets at BroadwaySF.com. Brevo, helping businesses work smarter, not harder, to help deliver customer experiences across email, SMS, WhatsApp, web push notification, chat, and more. More at brvo.com. That's brevo.com.
Funding for Here and Now comes from TimberTech, committed to providing sustainable decking materials in a variety of wood grains, textures, and colors to help expand a client's design potential. Project planning resources and cost calculators are at timbertech.com.
It's Here and Now. This month marks 2 years since the Supreme Court struck down the landmark decision of Roe v. Wade. And since then, it seems the map of reproductive rights across the country has become a hodgepodge of different laws, rights, and restrictions across 50 states. We're going to take a moment now to pull back and explore the lead-up to this new reality, starting about 10 years before the justices overturned Roe. A couple of reporters teamed up and investigated what happened in those years, and they uncovered far more than the culminating appointment of three conservative Supreme Court justices. They found what they call an entire ecosystem of interconnected conservative Christian lawyers, lawmakers, and activists pursuing the end of abortion access. And they have a new book out this week called The Fall of Roe, The Rise of a New America. Lisa Lehrer is a national political correspondent for The New York Times, and Elizabeth Dias is The New York Times national religion correspondent, and they both join us now. Welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having us.
So I want to begin way back in 2012. Barack Obama wins a second term in the White House, and Republicans want to figure out why they lost so badly. And so they put together this so-called autopsy that basically concludes that America is changing demographically and they need to catch up. But you all describe this as a moment of awakening for some in the anti-abortion movement.
Yes, Asma, that's really where our book begins. America was growing more secular. Barack Obama had just won re-election. The country was on the verge of gay marriage. It was becoming legal in a lot of states. And abortion felt like this issue that was left to the past, that people were sort of over and felt like this sort of dated political conflict that nobody was really thinking about anymore. And that's exactly when they decided to claw back and rebuild their movement.
So during this time period, it's also a phase when Republicans seem to be winning back control of a number of state legislatures. You're seeing supermajorities in some states. They are controlling various governors' mansions as well. And as a result, you're seeing these state laws restricting abortion. It seems like this was all part of a broader network. Can you describe this network of interconnected activists and policymakers? What did it look like during this time period?
Sure. One of the things we think was so hard about trying to understand what happened during this time was just how much was actually going on. All this was happening kind of piecemeal. We saw the most anti-abortion bills that state houses had passed all over the country with the rise of the Tea Party. But in the deluge of information about this abortion law here, that abortion measure there, it's hard to see the big picture, even for those of us who have been watching this really closely. So one of our goals was to really write a narrative about this time period in a big picture way for the first time, mm-hmm. and look at all those little puzzle pieces everywhere And so all of those individual puzzle pieces actually fit together what we can see now as being a much bigger story. And that's what we wanted to be able to show readers by connecting all the dots between lawyers, activists, lawmakers, judges, etc.
Yeah. You know, I will say in reading your book, I was struck by how systematic it all seemed in hindsight. Like there was a plan waiting in the wings. You know, if you fast forward to when Donald Trump became president in 2016, it was as if there was this conservative ecosystem that was ready. And you guys describe this, where there were major players in the anti-abortion movement that stepped in to take a variety of roles, kind of a top-to-bottom approach within the Trump administration. Can you describe how that happened?
Well, first of all, they jumped on the Trump campaign. You know, Trump was never this movement's first choice. And they weren't sure he would be a strong ally. But once it was clear he was going to get the nomination, they embedded themselves in his campaign in every place they could as a way to sort of leverage power and attach themselves to the Trump train. And it proved to be a bullet train for them. And it took them right into the heart of power. They were systematic in a lot of ways. What the anti-abortion movement had been really good at was seeing opportunity and figuring out how to wedge in and leverage that opportunity to their advantage, whether that was in a statehouse somewhere or that was in the incoming Trump administration.
And this is a movement that thinks in generations, not just in political cycles. Mm-hmm. And so they're thinking in this long term in a way that gave them an advantage over many of their political opponents. So that meant that whenever there was any opportunity, even if it looked like a small outside chance, like Trump getting elected to the White House, they leaned in. Mm-hmm. And that meant that they could get their foot in and start to get to work on their goals ahead of other people.
You wrote here, their work offered a vision of what a modern Christian empire looked like. It did not involve violent crusaders or declaring an official state religion. It was not clerics instituting a theocracy. The anti-abortion movement had used the existing system to define the Constitution the way it saw fit. I mean, fundamentally, that sounds like it's about the intersection of religion and power.
It is about the intersection of religion and power. And that involved, in this case, really working to pass laws, get them through the court system in order to reshape the interpretation of constitutional law. And then the effect of that results in a certain kind of culture, right? It's easy to think about cultural change as being the thing that first, you know, starts and trickles down into politics. But what the story of the fall of Roe revealed to be true is that actually it can be the opposite, and you can have a minority opinion take hold first and use the law to reshape the culture. And that's, in fact, often how change happens in America.
I want to ask you both about what was happening on the abortion rights side of the equation during this same time period, the second term of Obama and then Donald Trump's time in the White House. What sort of organization or infrastructure, if any, were they building? Because what you guys described in the book, it sounds like they were caught somewhat flat-footed as Republicans and conservatives were moving through to create these changes.
Well, I think what the abortion rights movement was looking at was really how to destigmatize this procedure, how to sort of change the culture around abortion so it would become more accepted overall. You know, you started seeing abortion show up in, remember that movie Juno, other sort of plot lines and things like that, and they worked on things like that. And of course, they were aware of the laws, you know, passing through these states, these increasingly restrictive laws going through conservative states. But, you know, I think there was a sense that they had the Supreme Court and that Roe didn't feel like it's something that could fall. And then Trump wins, and overnight, everything changes, right? He gets not one, not two, but a really unusual three Supreme Court justices. And it turns out, while the abortion rights movement was trying to sort of change public opinion, the anti-abortion movement was finding ways to amass power, either through conservative state houses, in the White House, in the courts, and create this, what became, by the time Biden won, was pretty much an all but unstoppable machine. There was nothing at that point. There was very little, at least, that the abortion rights movement could have done to stop this case at that point.
You know, one thing I really appreciated about reading the book was that it put human faces to these big abstract policy ideas. And one person, one character that really stood out to me is this woman, Marjorie Dannenfelser. Can you tell folks who she is and I'm curious why you all, you know, obviously centered her. She clearly plays a big role in this all, but what does she symbolize in the broader movement?
Sure. Marjorie Dannenfelser leads Susan B. Anthony Pro-Life America, the leading anti-abortion political group in the country. She actually started it when she was in her early 20s, new to Washington, a recent convert to Catholicism. It was 1992, the year of the woman. So many people nicknamed it. All these Democratic women have been elected to Congress. Hillary Clinton first came into Washington as the first lady, and Ruth Bader Ginsburg was soon nominated, confirmed to the bench at the Supreme Court. While all that was going on for liberal women, there was actually a small group of conservative Christian women like Marjorie saying, you know, we just have a really different idea of what it means to be a woman in politics. And so that's actually kind of the origins of the modern anti-abortion movement. They devoted their lives to overturning Roe and ending abortion in America. While many people may be familiar with, say, Cecile Richards, right, who was a longtime leader of Planned Parenthood, you know, there's another whole cast of characters, women on the right with very different cultural goals.
Mm-hmm. I've got to ask where you think this story goes now, because it feels like there are still so many unsettled questions. We're expecting some decisions from the Supreme Court that might also further affect reproductive rights, abortion. We're looking at a presidential election that's a rematch between Donald Trump and Joe Biden. Where do you see this story going from here?
Well, look, for the anti-abortion movement, the fall of Roe was not the end. It was sort of the beginning of the end. Their goal is to end all abortion across the country. And so part of what the fall of Roe did was plunge the country into these debates that we've never had before. Like, I think a lot of people, myself and secluded at sometimes, were shocked by hearing state legislatures debate whether 10-year-olds, you know, should be forced to carry a pregnancy to term. These discussions over rape and incest and miscarriage care and what constitutes a dire health emergency, a life-threatening one, or just a health emergency in pregnancy. So the country and lawmakers are really being confronted with these questions they were able to skirt for decades while Roe was in place. What that all tells us is that this is going to be an issue for a long time.
We've been talking with Elizabeth Dias and Lisa Lehrer of the New York Times. Their new book is called The Fall of Roe, The Rise of a New America. Thanks so much, Elizabeth and Lisa. Thank you both.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks, Asma.
It's Here and Now.
Live from NPR News in Boston, I'm Steve Brown. After years of delays, Boeing has for the first time launched astronauts into space. A pair of NASA test pilots blasted off aboard Boeing's Starliner capsule from Cape Canaveral, Florida this morning. They're headed to the International Space Station for a week-long stay. It was their third launch attempt, coming after a pair of rocket-related delays. The season's first heat wave is already baking the southwestern U.S. with triple-digit temperatures as Phoenix firefighters employ new tactics in hopes of saving more lives. Starting this season, the Phoenix Fire Department is immersing heatstroke victims in ice water on the way to area hospitals. The hospitals have also recently begun adopting the technique as a go-to protocol. Experts say it can dramatically lower body temperatures in minutes. Military officials in Lebanon say their soldiers shot and captured a gunman who attacked the U.S. embassy near Beirut after a shootout that wounded an embassy security guard. The attack took place today as tensions continued to simmer in the tiny Mediterranean country, where months of fighting between Hezbollah militants and Israeli troops have displaced thousands along the border. Local media reported that there was a gunfight involving at least one attacker and lasting almost half an hour. You're listening to Here and Now.
Support for KQED comes from UC Santa Cruz, where researchers discovered how often sea otters, a threatened species, use tools when feeding to survive in a rapidly changing environment. More at ucse.edu. Summitree, wealth management engineered for life in the Bay Area, helping clients maximize opportunities through personalized financial planning and investment strategies for over 20 years. More at SUMMITRY.com. Thanks for listening to KQED this afternoon. I'm Dave Freeman. Good afternoon. Weather Service says beach hazard statement for high surf along the coast. The hazard statement in effect through tomorrow evening. Heat advisory also in effect through midnight tomorrow. Look for warm to hot temperatures today. Near the water, 70s, up to the 100s far inland. Hotter in the Sacramento Valley today, highs 100 to 105. The excessive heat warning remains in effect until 8 p.m. tomorrow night.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced, and your NPR station. From MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software for technical computing and model-based design. MathWorks, accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com. And Rhodes Scholar, a not-for-profit educational travel organization, offering adventures for adults in more than 100 countries. Learn more at roadscholar.org/explore.
It's Here and Now. The NBA Finals tip off tomorrow night at 8:30 p.m. Eastern Time here in Boston. The Boston Celtics take on the Dallas Mavericks, and the two teams have had a very, I would say, different journey to the finals. Boston dominated its division and only lost two playoff games. Dallas, on the other hand, struggled at times before finding its groove late in the season and keeping it through the postseason. Joining us now in studio to get a preview of the big game is NBA columnist and Boston University lecturer A. Sherrod Blakely. It is so good to have you with us.
You as well. Good to be here.
So the finals start tomorrow. The Celtics, the home team, the hometown team here in Boston where we are favored to win. Do they deserve this favorite status?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, when you look at what they've done in the playoffs with a 12-2 record, you look at what they did in the regular season, they had the best record in the entire NBA. In fact, it was one of the top four regular season records in Celtics history, which really speaks to how dominant they were and how historically dominant they were. So they have done all the things you're supposed to do to position yourself to be here. Because frankly, when you have the kind of season that they had, this is kind of where it should be ending in the NBA Finals. So they're exactly where they should be based upon the way they played this year.
All right. It still seems, though, like some folks doubt this Celtics team. Mm-hmm. Where is that skepticism coming from?
Well, they are an example of what happens when the bar of excellence is ridiculously and insanely high. You know, they'll win a game by 10 and people think they should have won by 20.
Huh.
And if they lose a game, and when they lose a game, the world is falling. No one is any good. It's as if that they lost by 30 when they may lose by 3. So they have been dealing with expectations that are a little bit higher than most teams. But to their credit, they've been able to find ways to win and manufacture victories and position themselves to be in the last games of the season.
All right. So let's talk about Dallas, though, because they are not a weak team. And I'm curious what you think it'll take for them to win this series.
Well, they have arguably two of the top three, top four players in this series. When you talk about Kyrie Irving, former Boston Celtic, fans hate that, but he is one of a former player, and Luka Doncic, who's arguably one of the top two players in the NBA. If they're able to dominate the series and play at a level that just supersedes anything the Celtics do, that gives them a chance to win. The other factor is, Kristaps Porzingis for the Boston Celtics. How impactful will he be after having missed the last 10 games with a calf injury? So those are some of the things that, depending on how they play out, they could make this a much more formidable series for the Celtics.
All right. I want to ask you about viewership for the series, because I remember those glory days, Chicago Bulls, Indiana Pacers, 80s and 90s games used to bring in millions. I mean, talk about tens of millions of viewers. And now what's it like, around 11 million people, I believe, tuning in? Do you think that this waning interest signifies something, and why should we be paying attention to that?
Well, I think what's happening now is you're seeing that folks have a more diverse palette of options. Back then, there really weren't a lot of things you could see other than the NBA Finals, but you've got the WNBA and all the amazingly awesome drama and storylines that develops, and you've got other sports as well. So the NBA has more competition, and they've had to recalibrate how they roll out their teams. And obviously, with the Finals, you never can control who's going to be there, so there's that dynamic as well. But certainly, they like the idea of having a major market team like the Boston Celtics in the Finals.
Okay, real quickly, who's your pick Who do you think's going to win?
Celtics in five.
Really? Celtics. No bias there? No hometown bias?
No. They're the better
Based
team.
Based in facts.
Based in facts.
NBA columnist and Boston University lecturer A. Sherrod Blakely with his prediction there. Sherrod, thank you so much.
No problem. Thank you.
You're listening to Here and Now.
Healthcare is a top priority for voters in the upcoming election.
It's important to note that Latinos have essentially had the lowest access to both health insurance and healthcare among any racial and ethnic group in the country over the last 10 years or so.
Our series, We the Voters, continues with a focus on healthcare and the uninsured on the next morning edition from NPR News.
Hear it tomorrow along with the California Report and KQED News early tomorrow morning at 2 until 9 a.m. Support for KQED comes from Xfinity. Customers can get wall-to-wall Wi-Fi with Xfinity Gateway and X-Fi Pod that extends coverage to hard-to-reach areas. Restrictions apply. Not available in all areas. Actual speeds vary. VisitorsCoverage.com offering both inbound U.S. and outbound U.S. travel, medical, and trip insurance, so travelers are covered for financial risks and medical emergencies wherever they go. Learn more at VisitorsCoverage.com. More Here and Now until 1, All Things Considered after that, at 2, The World, and the afternoon news ahead at 3 from the PBS NewsHour on KQED.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston and from BetterHelp, committed to helping clients with issues ranging from relationship challenges and goal setting to grief and depression. Learn more at betterhelp.com/public. And Boston University's Questrom School of Business, presenting the Is Business Broken podcast, conversations about the role of business, stakeholder relations, and government at bu.edu/Questrom or wherever podcasts are available.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Asma Khalid in Boston.
I'm Deepa Fernandez in Alameda, California. It's Here and Now. As immigration is once again front and center in the news, we thought we'd revisit a book that examines how immigration policy can impact a family through generations. It's the memoir Orphan Bachelors by California author Fei Miang Ng. In the book, Ng goes back and forth in time to tell the story of her family. Her father, who worked on ships that often took him away from home, her seamstress mother, her own life growing up in San Francisco's Chinatown in the 1960s and teaching at UC Berkeley in the 2000s. But all through it, we see the far-reaching effects of one of America's harshest immigration policies, the Chinese Exclusion Act, first signed into law in 1882. Orphan Bachelors is now out in paperback. Fei Miang Ng joined me when the book was first published last May. And Fei, the Exclusion Act prohibited skilled and unskilled Chinese laborers from entering the U.S., but there was an earlier act signed by then-President Grant, which also had a profound impact. Can you explain?
I'm going to keep it simple because it's so complicated and confusing, but we all know that the 1882 Exclusion Act was America's first legislation directed at nationality. But in 1875, there was the Page Act, in which Grant had called all Chinese women immoral, and he banned them from entering the country. So that ended America's open borders. We also know that exclusion was really a historic win for labor. After the railroad was built with 90% Chinese labor, the California Working Men's Party began the campaign, The Chinese Must Go. So exclusion prevented men from bringing their wives unless you were a merchant or a diplomat or a student, and they couldn't marry in this country because of the miscegenation laws, which were not repealed in California until 48, and in the U.S. not until 67. So it was impossible to have any kind of intimate life. And my father, who was an orphan bachelor for 8 years, he was continuously hollering that exclusion was a brilliant piece of legislation because it was bloodless. You didn't have to kill any Chinese babies. You just made sure none were born.
That point is made so powerfully by quoting your father, who says four generations of the unborn. Yeah. And I think for me, Faye, that really crystallized just what exclusion meant. It wasn't just simply keeping out a certain group of people. It was preventing more from being born for four generations.
And we just can't imagine the effect on the sexuality of Chinese Americans. This is not going away. It is ongoing.
Yeah. You mentioned orphan bachelors, and that's the title of your book. Who are the orphan bachelors?
I call them the leftover men, the men that could not have families. And my sister and I grew up with them in Chinatown. They would come to our grocery store and sit and talk and drink tea. My father would take us to the park, and we would call them all grandfathers because they had no family. So we were exposed to their sorrow. My great-grandfather lived in this country for 60 years before his granddaughter, my mother, arrived. Exclusion created this kind of incredible aloneness. And I think this is what the orphan bachelors taught me, how to be alone.
And because immigration to the U.S. was so limited, people had to resort to illegal means. Your father was a paper son. And
yes.
I want you to explain what that was, because it kind of blew my mind, I have to say, about how it was that people worked to try and get around these restrictions.
Yes. My father, at 16, memorized a book of lies, and he posed as a stranger's son. This stranger was a legal American citizen, and he came into this country. And he lived for many, many years under this paper name. And then in between 1956 and 1966, there was a program called the Chinese Confession Program, which was kind of a trick program luring these paper sons to come and confess that they had come in under these paper identities, these paper names. My siblings and I were all born in this period. I call us confession babies because we witnessed our father giving up his citizenship. He had to be amenable to deportation. He had to surrender his passport. This was all for a chance at naturalization. But he was demoted to resident alien, and that was humiliating for him.
Yeah, that must have been an incredibly hard choice. Do you confess and believe the government that you might then be able to live not with your paper name, but with your real name? Or is it a trick?
Exactly. There was no winning. If you didn't confess, the FBI could stop you anywhere, anytime, and demand to see your papers, and then you would just be deported.
And I found really powerful, I mean, you write throughout the memoir of how you came to be a storyteller, and your father seems like one of the biggest influences on that. And his use of words and imagery, I love this one quote: exclusion and confession, the two slamming doors of America.
Yes. Yes, my father was a kind of a poet. He was alone so much because he went to sea that he would read and he would write and he would come back and tell his stories. I mean, I was such a storyteller because I would go to school and I would tell all these stories about my father.
Mm. One of the things that you say, and I'm quoting here from your book, "I've struggled to balance duty with desire to do good by my parents, but also have my own life. What I can't teach and what education won't provide is the courage to put aside duty." And it just struck me that you just put words to the dilemma of so many immigrant children. I'm wondering if you've been able to find more answers for yourself.
I think immigrant children have to make really hard choices because our parents sacrifice so much, not only their landscape, but their language. And so there is no easy way to go forward. But I try to teach my students that you put yourself first, and then you can take care of everyone else.
You know, I want to ask you quickly about your mother, because she is a seamstress and she works very hard and she keeps the family running. And yes, the one thing that struck me was when your dad was away and you wanted to, on a ship, and you wanted to write a letter to him, you wrote and complained about your mother. And she edited your letter, but she left all the complaints about her in the letter. She didn't edit them out, and she let you send it to your father. And that just spoke volumes to me about your mother's character.
You know, and that, if anything, taught me about writing. I can write my truth, and I can send it across the seas to the man that I wanted to reach. And there was the other letter in which she wrote to him, and her words in English were, "Baby sick, come home." The way they cobbled together their English was amazing, because, you know, she had a waiter from Chinatown help her with this, a neighbor who was a waiter, you know, and the way these immigrants made language powerful with the limited words they had, they could do it. And so as a writer, that was my challenge. She had four words to reach through the waters to the captain to allow my father to come home. And so that is always my challenge as a writer. Mm-hmm. And she gave me that. She allowed me to write all these, you know, nasty stuff about my mother, and she allowed me to send that letter to him. And the fact is, I found the letter. He kept it.
Wow. That must have been precious to find.
They were extraordinary people. You know, there was a deep kindness. You know, there was suffering in so many parts of their lives. But there was just, you know, the fact that he went to Hong Kong just to get her snake oil to cure her courage after discovering her grandfather's suicide, that sometimes one act is enough. One act of love is enough.
Hmm. It's a beautiful note to leave it on. Fei Mian Ying's book is Orphan Bachelors. Fei, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for reading. And thank you for talking to me.
You're listening to Here and Now.
For months, hospitals across Gaza have been shutting down as Israeli raids and evacuation orders push from north to south. Without access to medical care, children there are dying. That report on All Things Considered from NPR News.
And it's coming up starting at 1 and also later this afternoon. Support for KQED comes from Genentech, a science-driven biotech company helping to transform how complex health problems are treated. Learn how Genentech is tackling some of the biggest questions in healthcare at gene.com/askbiggerquestions. KQED Live presents an evening of reliving the disco era's explosion in the Bay Area and a preview of the new PBS series Disco, Soundtrack of a Revolution, June 6th. KQED.org/live, supported by the San Francisco Symphony.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston and your NPR station. From MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software for technical computing and model-based design. MathWorks, accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com. And the Museum of Science in Boston, dedicated to inspiring a lifelong love of science in everyone, in museums, classrooms, and online, offering engineering design challenges, digital experiences, live presentations, and more. MOS.org.
It's Here and Now. Mexico City is veering dangerously close to day zero. That's the day water levels fall so low that the city's taps run dry. People in the city are already dealing with water shutoffs for hours, and when the water does come in, it runs brown. The crisis in Mexico City has been a long time in the making. For more on why it's happening and what could be done about it, let's bring in Jake Biddle. He's a staff writer with our partner at Grist. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So Mexico City is the largest city in North America. The metro area has over 20 million residents. I just want you to help us understand how dire this water crisis is and what it might mean.
Right, yeah. So Mexico City has had a difficult water supply picture for a very long time because as the city has grown, it has drained this very weak groundwater aquifer underneath the city that used to be a lake that was drained by the Spanish conquistadores. And in addition to that, the city imports a lot of water from reservoirs and nearby mountains, basically because there's been so little rain owing to El Nino and climate-fueled drought. Those reservoirs are just basically empty. So the city's, you know, what had been the best and most reliable is now basically empty, and that has left even some of the most privileged and best off neighborhoods without water.
You mentioned that this has actually affected even some of the more better off, wealthier neighborhoods and residents. Has that been the case for some time? And I ask this in part because I myself visited Mexico City just this past November, and when you stayed in the touristy areas, it didn't feel like you were particularly affected.
Right, yeah. So that's a really good point, is that a lot of people in the eastern part of the city, you know, millions of people in the worst off neighborhoods, have never really had consistent water access, right? The water is of very low quality, or they have to get it from a standpipe. They don't have piped water at all. But in the well-off neighborhoods, it's never really been an issue. But now, you know, because it's so dry there, they are being affected for what's, you know, more or less the first time at this scale, at least.
So what kind of choices are residents having to make now? I mean, do they have enough water to cook and to clean?
Right, yeah. So it really depends on the neighborhood and the time of day. But everyone's trying, I think, to, you know, reduce their normal usage for cooking and cleaning, right? So there's things you can do, like you take a shower and you fill up a bucket with water from the shower and you use that water to flush the toilet or something like that. But I think the other thing that a lot of, you know, wealthier middle-class households can do is they just buy more water, right? And there's trucks that go around and just deliver water to individual homes who don't want to have to rely on the rather faulty city water distribution system. Mm-hmm.
I mean, are there plans then to invest in building out the city's water infrastructure in the future? Because this sounds like a very unsustainable situation right now.
So the newly elected president of Mexico, Claudia Sheinbaum, and the outgoing president, López Obrador, they've both downplayed this crisis to a certain extent because they're the party that controls the government in Mexico City, so they didn't want to make too big a deal out of it. And I think that there's a consensus that the city has underinvested in water infrastructure, and there's not an immediate plan to turn it around. I think that the most jarring statistic is that Mexico City actually loses about 40% of its water supply to leakage from canals and pipes and underground distribution systems. So, I mean, they are, you know, billions of dollars away from fixing that leakage problem. And there's it's a huge load to get there just because of how long they've underinvested in the system.
Mm. I want to broaden the conversation out a bit because, you know, this is not a problem that is unique only to Mexico City. I mean, the city of Cape Town in South Africa almost ran out of water back in 2018, but it was able to avoid disaster by launching a successful public awareness campaign that encouraged people to cut back on their water usage. Your reporting says that it's unlikely that same strategy will work in Mexico. And why is that?
Yeah, I think that, you know, there just isn't quite the same level of public trust in the government in Mexico City as there is in Cape Town. The Democratic Alliance, the government of the Western Cape, has like a lot of popular support. And the city had the ability to go door to door and knock on the doors of high water users and plead with them to slow down. And the government of Mexico and Mexico City just doesn't have that same level of control and trust from the public.
Is it your sense that that these water crises, whether we're talking about Mexico City, Cape Town, et cetera, are more likely to increasingly become common? I mean, we're talking about an environment with climate change and increasingly droughts in certain parts of the world. Are we going to see more cities face these types of crises?
Yeah, I think so, because a lot of cities have built water infrastructure for a climate that doesn't exist anymore. They rely on rain to refill the reservoirs every year, and they hope that that'll be enough. There's kind of a big dollar amount between the water infrastructure that we have in a lot of parts of the world and the water infrastructure that we need for, you know, both a growing population and a changing climate.
All right, so before I let you go, I've got to ask, I mean, if Mexico City runs out of water, what happens? And frankly, how far away is this idea of a day zero?
The idea of day zero, like, it will inevitably be temporary, right? Like, when El Nino fades and the rains come again, then the water access will be restored. It's not like the city will run out of water permanently in those better off neighborhoods. But for other parts of the city that rely on the aquifer, which has been drained for like 100 years, it's not ever coming back, really, just because it's wet now. So that, in those cases, the city will have to spend and increase the infrastructure and import new water in order to make that situation right.
Yeah. That's Jake Biddle, staff writer with our partners at Grist. Thanks as always, Jake.
Thanks so much.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Asma Khalid in Boston.
And I'm Deepa Fernandez in Alameda, California. It's Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from Loomis Sales, working to fulfill the investment needs of institutional and retail clients worldwide by integrating proprietary research and risk analysis to develop a customized approach for each investor. LoomisSales.com.
Today on KQED's The Bay, applying for student aid was supposed to be easier this year. It wasn't. We're going to hear how problems with the FAFSA have affected students across California. Find The Bay wherever you get your podcasts. Another hour of KQED News coming up at the top of the hour, and then followed by All Things Considered on this Wednesday afternoon, just a minute.